This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm Brandon Onick. I direct the Citrus Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. I wear a lot of hats, and I wear a lot of hats because the very nature of tech policy is multidisciplinary. So I have a foot in engineering, another foot in the law school. I have a hand, I guess, another part of me at the Goldman School of Public Policy. I'm everywhere on campus because in order for us to move forward in this space, we have to engage all of those disciplines. So before I start, my whole thing is about demystifying emerging technologies. And in part because there are incentives to make technology sound more difficult than they actually are. One is for startups to kind of lean into the hype and get those venture capitalists to invest in them because it's the new greatest amazing shiny tool that's going to save humanity. Second is this idea that if it is so incredibly complex, there's no way members of Congress and state legislatures would have any idea of how to regulate it. It's just too difficult. It's got to be left to industry. Well, I don't agree. And after this presentation, you all will also, I hope, not agree with those tropes. Okay, so part of the problem that we have is this idea that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? Like you think about ChatGPT, you put in a prompt, you go to play with Midjourney, you put in a prompt and it spits out this amazing image. And you're like, how in the world did that happen? Or like using ChatGPT, write a skit or a poem or something and it spits it out and you're like, wow, that's really clever. I actually think ChatGPT is so stupid itself that it appears to have intelligence. And I'll talk more about that, why I think that. So it's sort of this idea of thinking of AI as this oracle, this all-knowing thing. It's so magic, right? You can talk into your phone and say, hey, Siri, do whatever, and it does it for you. But what's behind that is just data and models, and actually very simple ones on the continuum of different types of AI. And at the top of that list of people saying, look, the technology is so magical, it's so difficult and amazing, and going to have profound effects. At the top of that, who's this person? Sam Altman. Sam Altman is the CEO of OpenAI. If you remember a few weeks ago, he was ousted by the board. Any of you remember that? Yeah. And he was ousted by the board because of this growing tension in Silicon Valley about whether or not to ramp up AI development because of all the great benefits for society or to tap the brakes because the technology is too powerful and we don't know the risks. Well, it didn't go really well for the board. They were essentially ousted and Sam Altman's back at the helm. But now Sam Altman went to testify before Congress, and he testified before Congress to say, look, I've released ChatGPT. It's a very advanced technology, and I'm very concerned about the harms it's going to cause in the world. So, esteemed members of Congress, I want you to know that I, since I built it and it's part of the work that I do, we at OpenAI are the best positioned to mitigate those risks. We don't really need your regulation, but if you do regulate us, we're going to tell you the best way to do it. Okay, well, there's some truth in that, right? I can follow along. I kind of agree a little bit. But also, it's trying to lean more into that hype that the technology is so advanced, so mysterious, that only those with the insider knowledge are the ones to be able to regulate it. Okay, so what is AI? We're all talking about AI, artificial intelligence. We use the term all the time. I guarantee you, when you're talking with somebody else, and you're talking about AI, you have a concept of what AI is in your mind that's different from theirs. So let's do some level setting. And before I do that, a pitch. So I'm the host of a television show that's broadcast. Can you believe it? Still broadcast. Talk about technology. So I'm the host of a show called Tech Hype, where I sit down with experts and I debunk emerging technologies. We sit down, we debate what are the real benefits, what are the real risks, and what are the technical and policy strategies we need to implement now that'll better ensure we can harness this technology for good. So it is broadcast, but then it is redistributed through YouTube where everybody watches content, right? No one's tuning in with bunny ears anymore, whatever. But okay, so Tech Hype, in that we have those main episodes, and then we also produce Tech Hype TLDRs, Too Long Didn't Read, where I analyze and summarize emerging tech policies. I know I'm talking to a policy audience, so you do like to read bills and, you know, like regulations, but most people don't. So I do release these short TLDRs. We also launched our podcast last week, which will have more content. So first, in the demystifying AI, you engage with, quote, AI every day and in so many different ways. First, a recommender system. That is a simple form of, quote, AI. It's a form of machine learning. It's taking data points on you, your prior browsing history, and it's going to feed up the content that you like. Did you know that Netflix actually chooses different images to show different people? Because, like, they know what you might click on in that show. If you see a picture of, like, a gorgeous man or whatever, I don't know. But for me, always on Fridays, I love the Great British Baking Show. Guess what's at the top of my feed every Friday when they would release it? The Great British Baking Show, because they knew I wanted to watch it. Okay, so when we talk about regulating this technology, there's this spectrum of the types of technology. And I'll just go over that really quick, and then I want to talk about this AI legislation database. So we can think of AI as narrow is the end, like over here. Narrow AI is a simple form of AI. It's essentially like logistical regression, linear regression, machine learning. Okay. How many of you have taken statistics? Cool. One of my favorite things is when students tell me they want to do AI and I tell them to take stats and they don't want to. That's the basis. So you start there, and then all the way over here, you keep going, where we have sentient AI beings, right? Like Skynet. We're nowhere near here. We're clear over here. Even ChatGPT, even though it looks pretty cool, it sounds kind of smart, it's still very much closer to this side of the continuum. Now, at the Citrus Policy Lab, we track all AI legislation proposed at the federal level and in the state of California. We review each piece of legislation. Each piece gets a summary and it gets a topical tag. We tag it also with who introduced the legislation, Republican and Democrat, their home state, was it bipartisan, and what's the current status. And it's in Airtable, so you can go in there. You can actually download it as a CSV. You can play with it. You can see, okay, Republicans from the South, what types of legislation are they more likely to introduce? A Democrat from the Northwest, what are they more likely to introduce? It can be a lot of fun. Okay, while we're talking about AI definitions, I like to break it down into two categories of how we're defining AI. Now, we have how AI is being defined in laws and institutions. Now, at the top of that, in the United States, the National AI Initiative Act of 2020 is essentially our only big piece of federal law in AI. And that law, also I should point back, the database, guess how many pieces of legislation are in that database? There's like over 300. So there's a lot of pieces of legislation introduced, like always the bridesmaid, never the bride, never gets it passed, right? It just gets stuck in whatever. But the one that was able to pass, because it was a trailer bill on military funding, is the National AI Initiative Act. And that formed the National AI Initiative Office within the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And their definition of AI is a machine-based system that can, for a given set of human-defined objectives. Now, I emphasize that for a reason. Human-defined objectives, okay? And it makes predictions and recommendations. Well, guess what? New forms of AI can identify new objectives. And so they're not necessarily human-defined. So you're going to see in a later definition from the EU that they say human or machine-defined. Now, NIST, our National Institute for Standards and Technology, developed the AI Risk Management Framework, which was released last year. And a lot has been happening in that space. We've been developing profiles for the NIST AI Risk Management Framework to demonstrate how you can actually implement it in practice. Now, note, this is a voluntary risk assessment. No company in the U.S. is required to implement the NIST AI Risk Management Framework. So think about that. And I'm going to talk about the EU. Okay, so if we go to the EU, so the European Union, right before the holiday break, agreed to the terms of the European Union AI Act. The AI Act is the most comprehensive piece of AI legislation in the world. Now, why do we care about the EU? Well, we care about the EU because of the Brussels effect. Because the EU market is so big that any developer of an AI system, if they want to enter the European market, they need to be compliant. Now, all of you on your computers, you every day you go to a website and you have to click the accept or don't accept cookies. Okay, this is another example. The European Union passed the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, which required people to consent to the collection of their data. Well, for a firm operating globally, it's more efficient for them to just roll out a feature across everything rather than just geo-block it to one location. I guarantee you we're going to see the same thing in the AI development space, that an AI developer that's looking to sell their service in the European market will implement safety and security standards compliant with the EU, but then also roll them out in the United States. Okay, so the EU AI Act defines it here. You can see based on a machine and or human provided data and inputs. I like this definition better than the US one. Okay, so now we've talked about how AI has been defined by laws and institutions. It's probably pretty important we look at the actual field, right? So if we look at how AI is defined by computer science, it refers to the ability of machines to respond to stimulation and make decisions that normally require a human level of expertise. Now, machine learning is a sub-discipline of AI within computer science. And there are so many different types of machine learning, right? We have supervised versus unsupervised, deep learning, and reinforcement learning. And you can simultaneously have something that is supervised deep learning with reinforcement learning. You can have unsupervised machine learning with deep learning and reinforcement learning. You can have very many different combinations of these. And I want to give you some examples. So look at this list. All of these: supervised machine learning, unsupervised, reinforcement learning, deep learning, generative AI, foundation models, general purpose AI. It's too much, right? When I say AI to you, what do you think of first? Just yell it out and I'll repeat it for the listeners. Computer produced, okay. Robots, yeah. So probably something like generative AI, like ChatGPT, like those things that you play with, you feel like that's AI. Well, guess what? AI is in every part of your life right now, surreptitiously making decisions that affect your ability to exercise your rights, gain access to services, the information that you receive on social media or when you do a Google search. What's more prevalent in society, in our world right now, is machine learning. Now, machine learning, it's not that complex. It's not. It's statistical pattern recognition or correlations in data. And there are three main types. There's supervised machine learning, where you're actually training the algorithm with labeled data set. An unsupervised machine learning model, where the algorithm itself will analyze and cluster unlabeled data sets. And then third is reinforcement learning, where you have an algorithm where you're optimizing it for a certain outcome, and it's just going to do trial and error, brute force, until it starts to reach that outcome. So let's dig deeper into this. Okay, so here's supervised machine learning. So you can see in the bottom left corner, I have labeled my data. You know, that green round thing with the sticky thing popping out of it, right? That's a green apple. It can also be red, right? Looks like this. But look, okay, there's a green tomato. It looks a little bit different. I labeled that, right? It could be almost looking like a green apple. And then the red tomato, right? So I have told it, this is exactly what these are. This is what they look like. I take that labeled data. I train my model. I hold out a test data set. And I see how well does it perform on accurately predicting whether or not what it is looking at is a red apple versus a red tomato, a green apple versus a green tomato. And this is called false positives and false negatives. So for example, if it takes out this green apple and it says, oh, that's a green tomato, that's a false positive. Okay, let's move to the next one. Now, unsupervised machine learning. And I'm presenting this in the way that the field has advanced. Essentially, we started with supervised. Now we're moving on to unsupervised machine learning, where we developed these algorithms that can identify what we call latent factors or latent features. So it's going to look at that apple tomato, and it's going to identify certain features of it, right? The apple stem is more pointy. There's only one. The tomato, there's like five little shoots popping off. The apple has a different texture, right? It's going to look at those features, and it's going to start to cluster. It's going to say there's something about this. Now, this one, because it's clustering without that human control, it can have more false positives and false negatives, right? Because sometimes maybe the tomato would have speckling on it, speckled in, it kind of looked like an apple. So you would have to correct that in your model. Now, reinforcement learning. This is where we are right now. So in reinforcement learning, you take that unstructured data and you're going to try to output it. Like, it's identifying those latent features, and then you're going to punish it or reward it on whether or not it's achieving the goal of actually labeling them correctly. Now, ChatGPT uses reinforcement learning via human feedback. And that happens in two ways. Either when you play with ChatGPT and you go and you give it a prompt and you give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and it asks you, right? It asks you to comment and say, well, why wasn't this correct? You're helping to train that model. You're saying, no, this is a false positive or a false negative of how you're structuring this, and you're helping to train it. Also, the company itself hires a lot of people to go in and do this manually all the time. There is a very hidden cost in these models of humans training data. And there's actually a very large court case right now out of Kenya where they're suing OpenAI because they hired people there at a disgustingly low rate to train ChatGPT to not produce harmful content, which meant that those people had to review and read incredibly violent, terrible content. So I've already mentioned some of the challenges in the machine learning. The supervised, it requires human beings, right? You have to actually train it. You have to label the data. Unsupervised, it takes more computational complexity because it's going to try to identify all of these latent factors. And there's a higher risk of inaccurate results. Quickly, for example, let's say that somebody is getting cancer treatment at the Mayo Clinic. This is actually a space used in, AI is used a lot in doing screenings, looking at tissue samples, okay? So say you're at the Mayo Clinic and they send their data out to a third party that's collecting data, not only from the Mayo Clinic, but other clinics to identify whether or not cancer cells are prevalent. Well, it just so happens that maybe by the time everybody went to the Mayo Clinic, it was probably pretty likely that they had cancer. And actually on those Mayo Clinic slides was a little logo for the Mayo Clinic. So you already know what's happening. So what happened was the machine learning model didn't actually predict. They did at first that in those images with the Mayo Clinic logo, just in the image, that the cancer cells were present. But what it learned over time is that there's a very high correlation that if that logo appears, they have cancer. So then it's going to start predicting just because that logo is present, the person has cancer. Scary, huh? Yeah. I think it's a lot scarier than generative AI. And then we'll talk about reinforcement learning, but I want to show you something really fun. This is reinforcement learning. Okay. So they built this model. Okay. This is actually a machine learning model. Okay. All right. So what you saw, okay, there's a boat. So this is actually a machine learning model doing reinforcement learning. And they said, okay, what we want to do is we want to optimize this model. Just test it out. Test if it can work. We want the boat to win the race, okay? It's going to race against a bunch of other boats. The goal, win the race. You get the points. Keep getting points the more races you win, okay? So they did it. And like I was saying before, it's doing like this brute force of like reward function. So what it found out, the model had a little trip up here, right? Do you see it's stuck in this infinite loop Well, when it's stuck in that infinite loop, it keeps hitting these boosters. And guess what happens? It gets more points. So it actually gets more points by just sitting in this infinite loop than actually trying to win the race. Yeah. Crazy. Okay. So this, though, is called, what do we call them? And I'm forgetting the word for it, but it's like a, I think I have it coming up, but it's like this false reward function, a faulty reward function. That's actually what we call it. Okay. So it's a faulty reward function because they were optimizing, essentially, they weren't optimizing to win the race. They were optimizing for points, right? And this looks like a really silly, stupid example. But if you are optimizing, let's say, for cancer prediction, and you're not taking account that some of your slides might have a logo on it that's going to end up being correlated and will cause cancer. Like, it'll predict it that it's cancer. Okay, so now we're also in this new space of deep learning, right? So if we go back to that original diagram, we have computer science, artificial intelligence, machine learning. Now we have deep learning. Deep learning is actually also used by Google when you do Google Browse. Like, you search in the Google search engine. It's not new. It's been around since the 1950s, but we've had significant advancements, right? We have the computational power and we have the data available for us to be able to do deep learning. It's more complex. It does mimic the human brain. That's why it's called deep learning. It's based off of neural nets. And I will show you what we mean there. So you have your input layer of data, and it's going to look at all the different correlations and combinations of that data. And at some point, you can have so many layers where it's looking. And that makes it pretty hard for humans to decipher, well, what are those correlations that it was looking at to predict the outcome? So sometimes this is referred to as black box algorithms. How many of you have heard that term? A few. I will also say that it's not always true that they're a black box. There are things that you can use called counterfactuals in statistics, where you just change some of these input variables and you see how it changes the performance. Right? You like hold it out and you can see. All right, so some of the challenges of deep learning takes a large amount of data, powerful computing. That's why we only have some of the largest companies like Google and OpenAI that has been funded in part by Microsoft. Able to do this. There can be this lack of transparency, like I was saying, except that you can use things like counterfactuals. And then this idea of the faulty reward function, right? If you're not being conscious that if we're optimizing for X and X could be achieved through another method, we might not be getting the results we actually want. We're going to get those unintended behaviors. And then where we are now in generative AI, those are deep learning models that can generate high quality text, images, audio, and other content. So I'm sure all of you have played with ChatGPT and others, Bard, Midjourney. They're now being integrated into your software by default. So you buy a new Microsoft Office package, you're going to have it built in. Okay, the other big thing that has been in the news and is really targeted in legislation are foundation models. And because I'm at Berkeley, I just have to say it. Stanford coined this term and we all hated it. Not necessarily because it came from Stanford, but kind of. No, I do like Stanford, but they did coin this term, foundation models. And that was because up until this point, if you developed a machine learning model, you were developing it for a very specific task. Predict red apple, red tomato, green apple, green tomato. Now we have things called foundation models where on top of it, you can do different types of things. On top, like ChatGPT, GPT-4 is a foundation model. That model, you can generate all sorts of different types of text, right? Different types of things. And then guess where we're going now? So that was large language models. The students upstairs, where are we going? We're going to the LMM world. What's LMM? Checks notes. Large multimodal models. So you're going to start hearing more about LMMs. And ChatGPT-4+ is an LMM. And that means it can generate. Okay, yeah. So we're going from LLMs to LMMs, where your model can both generate text and images and video and voice and all sorts of things. right, on top of it. Okay, another definition in the EU is this idea of general purpose AI, which fits within the generative AI, where it's actually being used across a variety of domains. So you can see they're not calling them out as these LMMs, large multimodal models, but that's essentially what this is. General purpose AI is an LMM. All right, so now if we go to the regulation of AI, the big difference between the European Union and the United States is that they take an ex-ante approach and we take an ex-post approach. So ex-ante approach, they try to mitigate the harms before they happen by putting in safeguards, essentially making any developer of a high-risk AI system do a risk assessment, show that they have done that at, like, with some level of certainty that those risks have been mitigated, and then it can be offered in the European market. Now, in the United States, it's a little bit harder for us to do that. Instead, right now, what we're relying on is established law. So if the harm occurs from an AI-enabled system, then you can sue, right? So if, for example, you apply for a job, your resume was screened and it used terms that expressed your gender to say, no, you're not eligible. Well, that can be unfair. You have to have equal opportunity for being able to get a job. So you can sue afterward. Not great, right? But there has been progress in the United States to do more of that ex-ante approach, risk mitigation from the outset. If you remember earlier, I talked about the NIST AI risk management framework. That's essentially trying to do that, but it's a voluntary framework. No company has to do it. So the federal landscape of AI policymaking, we started back in 2019, and actually during the Obama administration, we started. Then also during the Trump administration, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, I think, did actually a pretty good job of pushing forward some guidance. But what really was crazy is now in 2023, well, now in 2024, but in 2023, we had the NIST AI Risk Management Framework released. We had a blueprint for the AI Bill of Rights released. The White House issued voluntary AI commitments where all of the large companies signed on. I wrote a piece about this that actually I think that this is really important and impactful, because in the United States, in the absence of comprehensive federal legislation, the best we can do right now is have the company say that they're going to do better. But that also means as a consumer, you should put their feet to the fire. If they're not doing what they said they were going to voluntarily, don't use their service. I know that sounds really easy, but I know we're all still going to use their service. But I would like to see some more pressure being put on those companies. And then we also see bipartisan frameworks of governing AI. Senator Schumer has been hosting a series of AI summits. And then the biggest deal is actually the White House issued its executive order on AI on October 30th of last year. And they outlined 8 priority objectives for the federal government to ensure that they themselves are developing and using AI in a responsible way. So as I mentioned before, in our Tech Hype series, we do these too long, didn't read, TLDRs, and I have broken down the White House executive order on AI into 8 parts, each for one of the 8 priority actions, summarizing what the federal government's going to be doing. So I hope that you check them out. And then mentioned before, the NIST AI Risk Management Framework, they have 4 components to it: mapping the context and the risk associated with your AI system, measuring those risks, right? You can't manage what you don't measure, what you don't know. Then you manage, and this is all within this governance system. Now, NIST is trying really hard to make sure that they are in alignment with other standards bodies, like the International Standards Organization and IEEE. Now, NIST went to the European Union and said, look, we know you're going to pass the EU AI Act. And as part of that, you'll have to do, companies will do these things called conformity assessments, which is pretty much like the NIST AI Risk Management Framework. A conformity assessment says, look, I have identified the potential risks. These are the mechanisms I've used to mitigate those risks. And this is how I'm going to mitigate them moving forward. NIST went to the European Union and said, hey, if a U.S.-based company does the NIST AI Risk Management Framework, is that equivalent, can it be, to the conformity assessment? What do you think the EU said? Oh, no. No, we're not doing that. No, they have to still do our conformity assessment. So NIST, though, has tried to do what they call crosswalks to demonstrate how the NIST AI risk management framework is very complementary and similar to a conformity assessment. But companies right now are going to have to do both. They would have to do a NIST, if they wanted to, it's voluntary. They do a NIST AI risk management framework and the conformity assessment. So as part of that work that we're doing at Berkeley, we produce this report. Now, this report demonstrates how if you are the developer of a general purpose AI system, right, an LMM, a large multimodal model, how would you actually implement the NIST AI risk management framework? And we walk everybody through it in our report. It's about 170 pages. No light reading. But that's how we demonstrate the work. And then NIST has also developed a playbook that has guiding questions for those govern, map, measure, manage. And I think that they have done a really good job. So, like I've said before, in the absence of any comprehensive federal legislation, we're relying essentially on regulatory authority. And those agencies right now have been issuing reports and guidance on the AI space. For example, NIST issued the NIST AI Risk Management Framework. The Federal Trade Commission is honestly the most powerful in this space because the Federal Trade Commission, through the FTC Act, has the right over unfair and deceptive practices. So that's their stick that they have against the companies, because if a company develops an AI tool that's unfair or deceptive, they can kick in. They published a post kind of explaining their regulatory authority in this space. And actually, next week, they're going to have a large hearing with guests. It's online. It's online, and it's a full day talking about the AI governance space. Okay, so we have some states doing things. I know Assemblymember Buffy Wicks is introducing some legislation. Also, Assemblymember Rebecca Bauer-Kahn and others. Now, because there's this absence of federal legislation, we're seeing states doing it. Now, that could be a problem, right? Because you won't have harmonization, except, like I said before, with the Brussels effect of the European Union, we can also have the California effect, which is documented. So if California gets out in front of it and puts in place a law, it can have a spillover effect on other states, right? Where they'll just take our legislation and put it through their legislature and get it passed. For better or for worse. I already mentioned the European Union and their work. They have been really pushing hard in responsible digital innovation. So you can see all of the work that they've been doing here. The Tech Hype TLDRs, we will do one on the EU AI Act after the final text is released. And they're really short, like 5-minute videos for each, you know, main priority action. So it's really digestible. I've already mentioned that, AI standards, intergovernmental. Of course, industry is leading in this space. So if I could leave you with one thing. Okay, so industry, even the EU AI Act, when it's passed into law, it doesn't say specifically what the companies have to do. It doesn't say you must do X, Y, and Z. It says you need to identify the potential risks, you need to mitigate those risks and communicate it to us. So there is so much room for the companies to determine and demonstrate what compliance looks like. And as part of the check on that, they have to publish these reports to the European Union. And the European Union will have those reports to say whether or not they did actually due diligence in identifying and mitigating risks. A lot of people think that it's, okay, we have this legislation, this law passed, build responsible AI systems. Well, actually doing that in practice is pretty difficult. Also, what's going to happen, and something I'm really worried about, is because we're going to have different states having different laws. We have the European Union. If it's different from the U.S., if we ever pass a U.S. federal law, that there will have to be compliance with all of these different rules. And it'll be inefficient for especially smaller companies to have that, those people with those skills in-house. So they're going to go to third parties. Right? And we're already seeing these third parties. You can see some of their names up here, like the Responsible AI Institute, Credo AI, where they will assess an AI tool for you. You give them their tool, and then they will assess whether or not you have done appropriate risk mitigation in alignment with the EU conformity assessment. They'll do the NIST AI risk management framework for you. My worry is that you're going to see a lot of fly-by-night third parties that'll say, okay, for X amount of money, I'll make sure, yeah, you fulfilled all the requirements. So how do we trust those third parties? There's some ideas of actually licensing them, licensing those third parties and doing audits on them to make sure that they're actually doing a robust enough job of identifying and helping to mitigate the risk for those companies. Okay. And I do have my contact information, but before that, and I'll go back to it, please check out TechHype. It's really cool. We have really cool people. How many of you know Bill and Ted from Bill and Ted's like the people of my generation? But I interview Alex Winter because he now makes documentaries about the effects of technology on society. And it's like an amazing interview. So I do have some cool people. And then our podcast there, if you'll check it out. And then there's my contact info if anybody wants to take a picture. Yeah, I think it's now Q&A. Great.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nonecki, for a fantastic talk today. And so we are going to move over to our Q&A portion.
I will kick it off. I have like 6 questions, but I will stick to one since lots of other people have questions. So, hi, I'm Kathy Senderling McDonald. I own a consulting firm called Catbird Strategies. And hi, have been learning a lot about AI, working towards a certificate in AI strategy at Cornell. And so one of the things that we learned about in that is this whole hype and winter kind of cycles that AI has experienced since the 50s. And you mentioned the big reason is the computational power and the data, of course, that they kept banging into a wall. And so I'm wondering, we're obviously in a huge hype cycle right now. Do you see that just going on, or could we hit another wall with this? And what might be sort of the reason that things sort of go and hitch up from this amazing growth that we're seeing?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I have hidden slides in this deck that talk about the AI winters. And like, yeah, exactly. It happened because we didn't have the computational power of the data. Now, I want to bring up one thing to answer your question. The White House, when they issued their executive order on AI, they called for the development of the National AI Research Resource. And in that, they allocated something like $30 million. Okay, that's nothing. That's not even playing in the same sandbox as OpenAI. In order for them to get the billions of dollars to build their own, like, huge AI system, it's going to be billions. And they need to actually get congressional authority by passing the Create AI Act. Is that going to happen? No. So essentially, like, the public sector being able to build their own might not even happen. Now, second, what I'm learning from my colleagues in this space is that computational power, it's actually not important anymore because they're developing way more efficient models. So one of the big things is around data, the collection of data. That's a big issue that we're hitting up against right now. Generative AI, all of those systems, they scraped large amounts of data off the internet. There are several lawsuits right now about whether or not that has infringed the copyright of those individuals. So as we get clarity from those, that to me would be the next break, like pat the break, if we find out that you can't scrape data anymore, because that's what they need. But then the computational, I think the more efficient models are going to be able to do a lot more with less compute power.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so we'll go ahead and take a question from online. And the first question is from Daniel Harris McCoy, who is with the Little Hoover Commission. Uh-huh. And they ask, late last year, Governor Newsom released an executive order on implementing Gen AI in California state government. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this document and what did it do well and or poorly?
Yeah, thank you so much. This is something I love to complain about. Okay, so yes, Governor Newsom issued an executive order specifically focused on generative AI and how state departments and agencies could harness this shiny new tool to make the government more efficient, effective, and let's say hopefully more equitable in its service delivery. First, I think don't chase shiny toys. We have other AI systems that are not generative AI that we can use that will definitely make the California state government more efficient, effective, and equitable. So my big worry is that we're focusing on that new toy. We're missing all of the other tools that we could have been developing and using. Now, whether or not it's been effective, I don't want to be a complete cynic. I almost would consider generative AI as like the gateway drug to AI. Because now everybody has seen it and they've experienced it. And they're like, oh, what is this thing called AI? Oh, and guess what? There's simpler forms of AI called machine learning that have been used for like 50 years. So that's the opportunity to me that the executive order, by bringing more awareness to AI, is actually opening up people to think about these other forms. And when you talk with people in the California state government who are implementing the order, they're not just focused solely on generative AI. Of course, the order requires them to, but it's generative AI and other forms of AI.
Hi, my name is Jody Samuels. I'm with the Foundation for California Community Colleges. So there's obviously a lot of talk about AI in higher education. But my question is more about some of what you mentioned with the lawsuits in terms of who is responsible and who is held accountable. And in particular, like you said, in the U.S., it would be suing for damages after something has happened. But, you know, it's very easy for someone to say, well, we developed this tool and we unleashed it, but then it's the users who did the nefarious things with it. So I'm curious to know your thoughts around sort of those ethical, legal issues associated with some of these tools.
Yeah, especially around the liability. This is such a good question. And the EU is grappling with this right now. Okay, so first, the collection of data, whether or not is legal or not. Oftentimes, prior lawsuits, just scraping of data is protected because it's publicly available. And it's whether or not it violates the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which would mean that you don't have authority to access. It would have to be, you have to go through a password to get it. But if everything's just on the web, you're free to scrape. So these cases, I think, are going to be really interesting about whether or not them scraping copyrighted data that then their model creates works that are similar, whether or not that is a new work or a derivative work that has effect on the value, that's going to get sorted out in the courts. Now, the second is like, who is liable? So the way that the European Union is approaching this right now, because they're the ones who I think are thinking more about it. So first, if you develop a tool and you cause harm, you're liable. Like if you develop an AI system that harms people, you're going to get in trouble. Now, that would be if you own it and it's proprietary to you and it's closed. Now, we were chatting because we actually got to meet with one of the EU Commission members who drafted the legislation, and they are opening. Okay, so you can have closed models and open models, right? An open model, like any open source software, you can release your model, right? And then somebody else can take it, download it, use it locally. Well, the crazy thing is with these new models, these big models, is that you can identify what are called the model weights. So I can essentially figure out like how is it making its predictions? And then I can also see any safeguards, like any little breaks that they put in. And if I can see those, I can reverse engineer it to remove them. So now all of a sudden, a large language model that has had these breaks put into it so that it doesn't produce child sexual abuse material, a nefarious actor could remove those and then now deploy on their own server the model that creates it. And we're asking this question of them of who is liable? How do you mitigate that risk? And should we even have these as open models? So it's a big, big challenge for both the EU and the US.
Great, thank you. And so our next question comes from our Zoom audience. Andrea McCall, who's with UCLA Health, how should entities as potential consumers of AI technology evaluate vendors effectively? For example, we may not have the resources to try to break the black box ourselves. So as you mentioned, we have to somewhat trust the vendor or third-party assessors. Or a shorter question, what are the top 2 to 3 questions to ask a vendor using AI, particularly foundational models, underneath their technology?
Yeah, these are really good questions. And I'm really happy to tell you that we have something called the UC AI Council. So I co-chaired the UC Presidential Working Group on AI that developed the University of California's Responsible AI Principles. We help to demonstrate how you would implement those principles in practice across high-risk areas. So within UC Health, within HR practices, within student experience of admissions to course, like alignment and pathways, and UC policing. And out of that, we established a permanent council, the UC AI Council. They have a subcommittee that is right now developing guidance for procurement. And there's a subgroup specifically focused on procurement within UC Health. Like, how do they evaluate these vendors? So yeah, we are doing this work now. And the questions I would ask of them, first, you have a lot of weight to throw at these vendors. The vendors often come to you like you need them, but they need you more, right? And the UC system is so large that once they're in, there's an incentive for them to be within that vendor system. So push on them and say, demonstrate to us, do an audit, do continuous monitoring to ensure that it is not producing false positives or false negatives in these high risk areas. So yeah, I'd put their feet to the flame. And don't like, make sure somebody from their team, a technical person, is present in the procurement meeting.
It seems to me, first of all, actually, thanks for a great talk. It was really very illuminating. There's a lot of parallels between some of the risks posed by AI and the whole climate change situation. One of them is that, you know, the climate problem wasn't fully recognized back at a time when we could really intervene to do something effectively about it. The other parallel is that some form of international cooperation will probably ultimately be needed. And I noticed you didn't talk much about international. You talked about Europe, but what about the rest of the world?
Yeah, I have a slide that I just zoomed past it. So we do have some international coordination happening through the UN and OECD and other, like, there have been agreements that are happening that we agree that this is a challenge and we need to appropriately address it, but we don't have agreement yet on how. So that's part of, and it is early stages, right? Part of doing this is figuring out, well, what are the potential risks? How do those risks evolve over time? And what are the appropriate technical safeguards that we have to put in place? But there is definitely international coordination. And then I think the other thing too about climate and foreseeing and putting in the appropriate safeguards early, I would say definitely let's not just focus on generative AI and foundation models alone. Those are the shiny toys right now that look really cool. They both fascinate and inspire fear in people. But guess what? There are more forms of simple machine learning in operation. The scale of it today is so much greater than that, and is affecting you every single day. That if we don't think about how to actually govern that first, there's no way we're going to be able to appropriately govern these larger models.
All right, great. And then so our next question, I think this is going to be our last question from Zoom, is from Vincent Ma, who's with the Berkeley Haas Alumni Network, a Sacramento chapter. What's the best way to balance the need to protect jobs, especially the middle high wage earners, from being replaced by AI, while at the same time not stifling innovation in tech and AI? Should the industry self-regulate, or do we require compulsory legislation?
I like this question too, because this isn't our first technological revolution, right? Like, we've been through a few. This is what, our fourth industrial revolution? Like, the amazing thing about human beings is that we can adapt and we change. There used to be somebody who had to sit in an elevator and just like push the button, right? Like, we do it now ourselves. Things change over time. So what I think needs to happen, we're at a UC, is there needs to be more education on how do we harness these technologies in a way that enable us to thrive in an ever-evolving workplace, right? Like, I don't think that the UC should prohibit the use of generative AI tools, because the cat's out of the bag, we're all going to be using them in our careers. So learn how to do it and learn how to do it responsibly. And then whether or not regulation stifles innovation, I think that that's an often used trope that doesn't have a lot of research behind it. Going back to climate, like clean energy, is one of the most highly regulated sectors, but also say it's probably one of the most innovative, right? Like, necessity is the mother of invention. The regulation can also create a more fair market, right? Where companies can compete with each other, where we share resources that actually allows small to medium-sized enterprises to grow. We don't have monopolies anymore. So I think it's more nuanced than that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.